this paper was important, and I'm glad that it is kind of getting some attention from coaches and fitness enthusiasts, because there are people out there who are making these recommendations to alter your training around the menstrual cycle, are saying, oh, this kind of phase-based training is all a one-size-fits-all, and make sure that you are really in the phase that you were intending to be, which is pretty complicated. And at this point, just probably really unnecessary.
7 reviews were assessed by you in terms of quality and heterogeneity. You have concluded that we don't have evidence to say the menstrual cycle phase will influence acute gains.
That's right. What we don't have is evidence to suggest that objectively your performance is worse because of your menstrual symptoms. There's sort of a difference between, yeah, you know, I don't feel well. I didn't feel like I had a great session today. But as long as they're kind of what would be considered normal for you, then your ability to, or propensity for muscle growth and strength gains are the same.
All right, Lauren, welcome to Evidence Strong Show. It's my pleasure to have you. If you could briefly introduce yourself.
Sure. I'm finishing up my PhD at McMaster University. Stu Phillips is my supervisor. And before coming to McMaster, I got a master's degree in exercise science from the University of South Florida with Bill Campbell. And my undergraduate work is in psychology and nutrition. And in addition to my academic background, I also have several years of coaching experience. And so I'd like to kind of keep a hand in that element of coaching and practical application, and remember the translational side as well as, of course, all the work I do in the lab.
What sport are you coaching?
Sorry, not sports, more just resistance training. For the most part, my clients were just kind of recreational exercisers who wanted to learn how to lift weights well and wanted to get stronger and build muscle.
Excellent. Okay, so I invited you to talk about the paper titled Current Evidence Shows No Influence of Women's Menstrual Cycle Phase on Acute Strength Performance or Adaptations to Resistance Exercise Training. So let's start with the goal of the study and why did you do it?
One of my goals in pursuing my graduate education has been to kind of further the area of research in women in the resistance training area. Because as I'm sure you may have discussed before on your podcast, there's a lack of research in women. And for many, many years, kind of the young, healthy men were the go-to population for exercise science research. One of the reasons that women are often excluded and that population of choice is young men is because women with menstrual cycles have fluctuating hormones throughout the month. And so there's an assumption that these hormonal fluctuations could potentially impact exercise performance acutely or resistance training induced adaptation. So, you know, how much muscle you grow, how strong you get over 2-3 months, let's say. And because it's sort of an unknown, people tend to shy away from studying women because having to kind of standardize when you would test, when you would train so that everyone was training according to a certain phase of the cycle, it would be very complicated from a research perspective. You know, so here we are, and there just really isn't as much work done in that population. But the reality is, like I mentioned, it's really an unknown at this point. So there's a few studies out there, but it has not been studied extensively. And so the question whether this matters or not is a really important one, because if it doesn't matter, then we can start including men and women in the same study, and we don't have to worry about when their cycle started or what phase they're in, or, you know, whether estrogen is high or progesterone is low. We can just have people exercise. If it does matter, then we can create some kind of guidelines for researchers to implement that accordingly. So, you know, in either way, it will further the research that can be done in women. The purpose of the paper was an umbrella review. And so it's essentially a review of reviews, but we also dive into some specific key papers. And we aimed to look at both acute strength performance, that could be a single exercise bout, you know, how many repetitions can you do, how much weight can you lift, how much power can you generate in a single session or a single bout of exercise. And we also looked at the evidence around the longer term adaptation, so the strength that you gain or the muscle that you gain after doing a resistance training program over a generally 2 to 3 month period.
I think we covered why the paper was needed. And you touched a little bit on the design. So not everyone knows what umbrella review is. You explained where it is, but now how technically you go about collecting your studies and how you decide which ones are included, which ones to discard, and so on.
This was an umbrella review, which is essentially a systematic review of meta-analyses and systematic reviews. So it sounds a little bit complicated, but it's essentially the purpose and structure of an umbrella review requires the researchers to be systematic in their literature search. And instead of a narrative review where you can kind of pick whatever papers you'd like to make your point, a systematic review needs to kind of thoroughly step-by-step review all of the relevant literature as a whole. And then we can kind of dive into the methodological quality of the papers and the findings. But it really allows us to take that kind of holistic view, as opposed to in some narrative reviews, you'll kind of see them, the authors taking the researcher conclusions at face value. And if we're going to be rigorous and think critically as scientists, we really need to critique each other's work and make sure that we're doing things properly from a statistics perspective, and we're doing things properly from a study design perspective. And you know, one of the challenges when you try to do a meta-analysis or a systematic review is that you're kind of pulling together studies that attempt to answer the overarching research question, but they're generally never designed exactly the same way. So we would refer to this as heterogeneity. And that might mean that the populations are slightly different, or the exercise test wasn't the same, or the duration of the training study was different. And so it means that, you know, it would be ideal if we could just compare 10 studies and they all did exactly the same thing, but that's never really the case. So we need to take the literature, you know, as it is, bring together the papers that are relevant to our research question as systematic reviewers, and then look at the methodological quality, the findings, and make our own conclusion based on the totality of the evidence as it stands today. We were looking at papers that assessed menstrual cycle phase and acute exercise performance and long-term exercise adaptations, and they needed to be a meta-analysis or a systematic review. So not individual studies. There were enough meta-analyses and systematic reviews and out there that we were able to, you know, conduct a thorough search for our analysis. Once we've done our search and we've pulled together the papers and we've made sure that, you know, we thoroughly searched the appropriate databases, then we start going through the papers and pulling out their findings, and then also assessing their methodological quality. And then we can kind of take it a step further. And if the authors pointed to certain higher or lower quality individual studies, then we can go and we can look at those papers as well. And that's what we had to do for the kind of chronic adaptations, because there are so few papers that that part of the question really isn't ready for a meta-analysis, because there just needs to be more work done.
Understood. Could you explain how you decided on the quality? Because you said that was the part of decision-making process.
Sure. Yeah. So we use a kind of standardized assessment called AmSTAR. And essentially, it goes through and it looks at potential risk of publication bias. It looks at the overall rigor of the methods. And so you kind of give a score, if you will, for each item on that list. And then we can say, okay, you know, this is of low, moderate, or high quality.
So before we dive into the results, could we just go briefly through the menstrual cycle so we're on the same page in terms of the phases and how it goes?
And I'll say this just up front. We're talking about women who are naturally cycling or have a menstrual cycle. And so this would exclude women who are postmenopausal and women who are on any kind of hormonal contraceptive. If you're on a hormonal contraceptive, you don't have the kind of cycle that I'm referring to here. There are, we would say on average, a cycle is about 28 days. In reality, there are people who have shorter cycles than that. There are people who have substantially longer cycles than that. And so we'd kind of say that, you know, that can range from maybe 21 days to 35 days, but average, we would be looking at a 28-day cycle. And the hormones that we're primarily referring to here are the ovarian hormones. So that's estradiol and progesterone. And then luteinizing hormone comes into play when we talk about ovulation. So at the beginning of the cycle, so when menstruation starts, all the hormones are low. Now, during the first half of the cycle, which we would refer to as the follicular phase, we see progesterone remain low, but estradiol starts to increase. And then it gets to its sort of highest peak mid-cycle. Again, that varies between people, but after estradiol peaks, we tend to see ovulation, and that is a pretty short but high spike in luteinizing hormone. After ovulation, we're in the second phase or the luteal phase of the cycle, and we have an increase in progesterone up until kind of mid-cycle, and then it starts to slowly decline. And then we also have another kind of increase in estradiol, but it never gets as high as its original pre-ovulatory peak. So we would say estrogen and progesterone are kind of moderately high during the luteal phase, and then both hormones levels slowly decline. And then that's the end of the cycle, and we start all over again.
Okay, could we just clarify where we start and where we finish in terms of how we count, which is day one and which is day 28?
Day one would be the beginning of the follicular phase. And then if you were to ovulate on day 14, then day 15 would start your luteal phase. And then that would go until you get your next period. On average, a cycle is 28 days in length. And on average, a person with a 28-day cycle will ovulate on day 14, so right in the middle. But there's a huge amount of variability here, not only in people's cycle lengths, but in their phase lengths as well. And so it's absolutely possible to have a 28-day cycle and ovulate on day 20. Which would mean you have a very long follicular phase and a pretty short luteal phase. It's also fairly common to have inconsistency from cycle to cycle in terms of cycle length, phase length, timing of ovulation. That can vary, as I said, substantially between people, but it can also vary within that one person from cycle to cycle. So maybe this month it's 30 days and next month it's 25 days, or this month ovulation is on day 12 and next month it's on day 16. Some people are very consistent, but there's a lot of variability there. And so that makes it challenging from a research perspective, for sure, if you're really trying to capture everybody in your trial during one phase. The easiest way to do this is to try to test people during the early follicular phase, because you know, when you start your menstrual cycle, when you get your menstrual period, then that's when the follicular phase starts. So that's an easy one to detect and identify. If you're looking for the late follicular phase or the mid luteal phase, then we really need to determine the timing of ovulation, because the late follicular phase will be prior to ovulation and the mid follicular phase will occur after ovulation. So one of the shortcomings of a lot of the work in this field is that researchers have not properly identified the timing of ovulation in their participants. And instead, they've just made the assumption that since on average, a cycle is 28 days, and on average, ovulation occurs on day 14, let's just say everybody is in their follicular phase for 2 weeks and everyone is in their luteal phase for 2 weeks, instead of actually determining whether they are or they aren't. And as I said, if you make that assumption for that person who actually doesn't ovulate until day 20, then you're just not answering your research question. So one of the goals of the paper was also to really highlight the methodological issues in this body of literature and encourage researchers moving forward to use better practices to really make sure that we're being thorough in cycle tracking leading up to the trial and during the trial, and then also identifying the timing of ovulation and the hormone levels. And so doing blood work if you can. Ovulation can also be identified using urinary reactive strips, and that they pick up that spike in luteinizing hormone. It's also important to actually measure the hormone levels throughout the cycle, or at least throughout the phases in which you're doing your tests, because then you can really demonstrate that, yeah, on average, people do follow this pattern of hormonal fluctuation, but everybody is a little bit different. And if your ovulation is later in the cycle, then everything I described is going to be kind of shifted over. And so you'll have a longer time spent with that increase in estradiol during the follicular phase because you have a longer follicular phase. So all of this individual variability that I'm describing makes this challenging, because when we do research, we're looking at group level averages. And one of the biggest take homes from, you know, really diving into this literature is that the inter-individual differences are overwhelming. We really just can't look at this as a one-size-fits-all kind of cookie-cutter solution for women.
So interesting. Very, very complicated. So I think we're ready to hear what have you found, what were the results of the review.
Sure. So in terms of acute performance, we really didn't find that there was substantial evidence to conclude that cycle phase will predictably influence your exercise performance when it comes to resistance training exercise performance. So to be clear, this is people who are lifting weights. We're not including kind of aerobic exercise in this conversation. And there's one amazing meta-analysis that we included in our paper. The first author is McNulty. They found that perhaps there was, they referred to it as kind of a trivial effect for the early follicular phase. But because of the quality of the papers looking at this question, and because of the variability that I just described, they concluded that, you know, we really are not in a position to make any kind of recommendation, because there needs to be more high quality work done in this area. And they are also, when I say high quality, I mean people really kind of using these best practices, because we're trying to lean on results from studies that may have not used methods appropriate to answer the research question. And so that's very tough, right? Because if they say, oh, we found a difference, but I look at the paper and I say, well, you don't really, you didn't look to see if they were actually in the phase you thought they were, then that to me, I can't put a lot of weight on that finding, because we don't know if they really answered the research question. It is sort of the issue there. When it comes to the long-term adaptation, so the muscle growth and the strength gains, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, there are very few studies that have looked at this. And I can imagine one of the major reasons is the tremendous challenge that it would be. And we concluded that because of the quality of the evidence, again, we're not in a position to make any kind of broad recommendations, and that at this point, coaches and athletes should be looking at this on an individual basis. Again, I go back to the kind of methodological flaws here. There is a pretty widely cited study that reported that training in the follicular phase was preferable for strength and muscle growth compared to training in the luteal phase. The issue that I highlight in that paper is that they did not use at the gold standard methods of detecting ovulation and measuring serum hormones and doing the cycle tracking. And we really need to see that study design repeated. But the issue here is that people have really kind of clung on to this one paper, and then the narrative has become, follicular phase is better. There's something kind of magical for muscle growth or strength about estradiol, because like I said, you know, that's the hormone that is high. Or the flip side of that is, there must be something terribly catabolic and problematic about progesterone when it comes to muscle. And there's so much mechanistically even that we just don't understand about the actions of those hormones when it comes to muscle. But when you go back and you think about the number of days that we're talking about high estradiol in a given cycle, and then remember that I also said estradiol is moderately high in the luteal phase as well. So we're talking about kind of net similar levels of estradiol. And the narrative that, the luteal phase is bad because progesterone is somehow counteracting those potentially positive effects of estrogen, we just have no evidence to back that up. Even in animal models, like, we have nothing. And so there's so much more work to be done here. And, you know, from a kind of scientific perspective, I would love to learn more. I hope we continue that work to really enhance our understanding of the role of these hormones.
So just to understand what was the extent of the review, you mentioned one meta-analysis you included. How many did you end up working with?
There were seven that we included.
These are seven reviews with meta-analysis. So like combining the individual studies and trying to analyze them, seven of these were assessed by you in terms of quality and heterogeneity. So these were good enough to include, they were relevant to the topic, to the research question. Mm-hmm. And after looking through seven of these, you have concluded that we don't have evidence to say that the menstrual cycle phase will influence acute gains, and for the long-term gains, we have too little studies to even be concluding.
That's right. When you say good enough, I just want to clarify. Yeah. When the studies that we included, they are criteria, our inclusion criteria, which we determined before we even did the literature mm-hmm. search. So for an example of something that might not be appropriate would be the influence of menstrual cycle phase on thermal regulation or endurance exercise. So those kinds of meta-analyses would not be appropriate for what we were looking at because it was just resistance exercise. And then the other kind of piece of this that we did not include is the influence of hormonal contraceptives, because that's kind of a separate question. Those are exogenous hormones. And what we're talking about with the menstrual cycle is fluctuations in the endogenous hormones that we produce. And I want to be careful with the language here. We said the evidence is insufficient. And so as a scientist, I keep an open mind. I'm absolutely willing to change my mind should there be more high quality work done in this area that indicate that these short-term hormonal fluctuations are important. But I think that this paper was important, and I'm glad that it is kind of getting some attention from coaches and fitness enthusiasts, because there are people out there who are making these recommendations to alter your training around the menstrual cycle, are saying, this kind of phase-based training is all a one-size-fits-all. And as I mentioned, throughout this conversation repeatedly, there's so much variability between people that if I give you a phase-based training program and I have no idea what your cycle length is or what your phase lengths are or when you ovulate, then you're not even doing phase-based training necessarily. So in order to implement this, you would need to track your cycles, track your ovulation, and make sure that you were really in the phase that you were intending to be, which is pretty complicated. And at this point, just probably really unnecessary. But you know, I think it's really important to kind of get this message out there because I am familiar with these programs or influences who are making these recommendations. The last thing that I touched on in the paper, but it's kind of come up more since, is the influence of menstrual symptoms on performance. And it hasn't really been studied very much in a kind of objective way. There's a lot of surveys that have assessed athletes and said, you know, do you experience menstrual symptoms? What are they? When do you experience them? And the overwhelming majority of women report that they do experience symptoms. The most common ones are like abdominal cramps. They generally experience those symptoms either right before their period or maybe in the first few days. There is a certain perception that those symptoms could influence your exercise performance, which makes sense, right? If you're not feeling great, then maybe the training session just doesn't feel as good. The same way if you were really tired or if you were a bit sick and you just don't feel that you had as productive a session. What we don't have is evidence to suggest that objectively your performance is worse because of your menstrual symptoms. So there's sort of a difference between, yeah, you know, I don't feel well. I didn't feel like I had a great session today, but maybe you lifted the target weight for the target reps and on paper you had a fine training session. So those are kind of two different questions. But when we look at the research of where they did testing in the early follicular phase, we need to be mindful of the fact that testing during the late luteal or early follicular phase is around that time where the majority of women do report experiencing some symptoms. And so even that kind of subjective data is not generally collected. And so I hope in future research, that's another thing that the researchers will consider and some data that they would collect. Even, you know, it's just self-report, right? But it would be good to know, because it's a different question to say, is there something about these hormone levels changing from day to day, week to week, that is physiologically influencing our ability to exert muscular force or build muscle or build strength over time? That's a different question than to say, when I have menstrual symptoms, is my performance affected because I don't feel well? And so I think we do need to make that distinction. But certainly as an athlete or as a coach, that's something that you would want to keep in mind and have an open dialogue about. And then, you know, you can make some adjustments as needed to one or two training sessions.
In terms of Olympic weightlifting, there are some studies, for example, how sleep deprivation influences performance in Olympic weightlifting. And what seems to be happening is that the mood and enjoyment of training goes down, but mm-hmm. the actual maximal performance, so one repetition maximum, does not.
Right.
So maybe it's similar in this situation, that the symptoms are unpleasant, but actually mm-hmm. they don't impair the maximal performance. And in Olympic weightlifting, that would be the goal, to lift the most in snatch and clean and jerk. So a very specific goal to achieve in terms of performance. So, you know, as long as you can perform at your max, within, you can feel miserable for the rest, and it's totally fine.
it's one thing to say, oh, if you're not feeling great, you can adjust your training session. But of course, if you are a competitive athlete and you need to perform that day, and you don't have control over that, the competition is when it is. And if your cycle starts, and you know, you're probably going to suck it up and compete anyway. It's interesting because the survey data that reports, I think over 75% of women say that they do experience regular menstrual symptoms, and that they do perceive that it negatively impacts how they feel or their performance in the gym. But very few of them reported making any kind of changes to their training accordingly. I think the flip side is actually that sometimes exercise at even like a light to moderate intensity can make people feel better when they have things like abdominal cramps from the menstrual cycle. So there isn't a lot of hard science to go on, but I think it's something worth bringing up when we're talking about the real world implications of the influence of the menstrual cycle, because I think experiencing those kinds of symptoms is tangible. Whereas I don't know when my estrogen is highest. I don't feel it throughout my cycle. And so the influence of menstrual symptoms on how you feel in the gym is something that is very tangible for an athlete. And it's something they can explain to their coach. And it's something that you can kind of make adjustments or not as needed. And I think it's important to kind of distinguish that from what we primarily talked about in the paper, which is the idea that there's something about high estradiol or low estradiol or something about high progesterone that is positive or negative for performance. And so I do like to separate the two, but I think it's important to bring up the menstrual symptoms because they're clearly so prevalent. And of course, if you are a high level athlete and you really want to do everything to kind of dial in your performance, then perhaps it's worth at least documenting in your training log when your cycle starts and just being aware of whether it's a subjective thing that you just don't feel as well when you start your period, or if there is actually something going on where the numbers are dropping when you get your period. And if that's the case, then perhaps there's some kind of modification that you would want to make to a training session or not. I think it's really up to the athlete and coach.
Thank you. That's some good advice. So the goal would be to pay attention for some time, figure out how it applies to you as an individual, and then maybe if you notice that some symptoms are common, you can prepare for them ahead of time or make some adjustments, maybe in self-care or how you come to the session or what you bring or what you need to keep yourself feeling more comfortable and having less symptoms.
I wouldn't necessarily predict that you would need to make any adjustments or that you would even see trends, but if you wanted to log that and track that just, for your information or for your coach's knowledge, then I don't see any harm in doing so at all. I think that it depends on whether it seems appropriate for that particular athlete. One thing I will notice with my clients who track is that it's very common for body weight to go up during the first week of the menstrual cycle. So if you are having somebody who's tracking their body weight consistently and you see kind of an increase in scale weight around the onset of menstruation, I would kind of throw out that data when I'm looking at like weight loss trends or things like that, because it's not a real increase in body fat. It's usually just, artifact of water retention.
Okay, that's an important point, because Olympic weightlifting is weight class contested sport. So any fluctuations regarding body weight are applicable and important and sometimes harmful. Yeah. So that's maybe one case where having awareness where an athlete is before the competition in terms of where they are in the cycle may be useful to expect things like 2 kilograms more just because they're starting the period.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I have a client who is competing in a powerlifting meet on Saturday, and I spoke to her yesterday and we were looking through her kind of weight trends, and she is exactly what you just described. You know, it's like about a 2 kilogram weight increase, but I also know that that only lasts for a couple of days. And so we won't need to take that into account for her Saturday weigh-in. But, you know, of course, if it had been last Saturday, then it would have been something that we would have to consider for sure.
Any other considerations or usefulness of the results of the review the athlete should be thinking about, or the coach?
No, I think that, you know, in the absence of additional evidence that indicates otherwise, we need to be viewing the menstrual cycle as just kind of one other factor that if it has an influence, it's probably very minor. Perhaps it would apply to some individuals, but in broadly speaking, and in terms of just making kind of practical recommendations, I actually think it can be more harmful than helpful to tell women to completely overhaul your program based on your menstrual cycle phase, because you're thinking about, you know, potentially half the month either doing lower volume or not lifting at all. And the recommendations are kind of all over the place, but usually it involves doing less during your luteal phase. And, you know, I just think that you're potentially hindering your progress if you do that, and without good reason. I really think that I would shy away from doing any kind of programming around cycle phase until we have a substantial amount of high quality evidence indicating that otherwise.
Where people can find you if they want to learn more about your research or what you do, or contact you, where should they either go?
So if you're a scientist, then I'm on ResearchGate. That's where I post all of my papers. I'm also on social media at LaurenCS1 on Instagram. I'm on Twitter as well. And so feel free to send me a message if you have any questions. And I will continue to share my research on social media. And I'm also a writer for the research review MASS, or Monthly Applications in Strength Sport. So you can check out some of my reviews of the latest research on exercise and nutrition at strongerbyscience.com/mass.
Awesome. Thank you so much, and see you the next time.